Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Hello Rank Squad and welcome to Champions League Takeaway, your extra little feast after the Champions League madness here on Ranks FC. My name is Jack Collins and I'll be your host today, and joining me across the water in San Diego, Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Hello, mate. Yeah, that's a bit of a crazy day you've just had there. I mean, still, the day is nowhere near complete for me, but for you, your brain must be fried. You've done a full day of work, then had to digest all that Champions League, and now you're jumping on to regurgitate everything you just witnessed.
It's been busy today. Yeah, I was on the radio in the morning, went in to do some Fulham stuff, came away from that, you know, sorted it all out, watching all of these games, trying to keep across everything. It's been a challenge, but I've enjoyed it. A lot of screens, a lot of games, a lot of goals. So it's been exciting. We're going to start today, I think, with Wednesday's action, with the things we've just witnessed while they're fresh in our brains. And then in part two, we'll discuss all of the Tuesday bits and bobs as well. But Dean, it feels like the only place we can start is Aston Villa beating Bayern Munich 1-0. Now, before this game, talking to some Villa fans and looking for kind of moments of optimism. And I think the mood was pretty good. It was a pretty kind of, feels a little bit like a free hit in that they're coming to Villa Park, first game. Last week felt, I think, a little bit like a warm-up game for the Champions League, because Young Boys felt like the kind of opposition the Villa could have met in the Conference League last year, right? And also the artificial pitch, the fact it was actually so easy for them, all of that kind of combined felt like this was the real moment that Villa arrived back in the Champions League. And interesting, obviously, that it was against the team that they won the competition against in 1982. Now, I was talking to Jacob Townswell on the radio, who's the Aston Villa reporter for The Athletic, and him and I were both discussing the fact that Villa have looked a little bit weak on the flanks over the last couple of games, and Ipswich took full advantage of that at the weekend to draw 2-2 with them. And in the first 20 minutes or so of this game, Bayern did too, right? They absolutely dominated either side of it. Every time they got into the box, they felt like they were going to make something happen. But Villa grew into this game. And it's really cool to see, one, Villa back on this stage, a club of that history, that prestige, a massive club. You feel it when you go into Villa Park, what an incredible and historic place it is. And you see the banners about Peter Wirth and all of these things. It's easy to forget that Villa have been here before, because there's been such a period of their absence. But I do think you kind of come to this and you think, well, are Villa about to re-announce themselves on the big stage? And if so, who better to be at the helm than Unai Emery? Now, Bayern probably have the edge everywhere across the pitch in terms of who they've got, maybe not in goal, but generally across the pitch. But in the dugout, you have Unai Emery and his incredible record in Europe. You have the fact that he was the last manager to beat PSG in what was then the group stage, obviously now the league stage, of this competition back in 2017 with PSG. And now he's masterminded this victory over Bayern Munich. And I thought that Villa learned as they went on through this game. They grew into it, as I say. And it felt like by the end of things, the correct team in so many ways won.
That's good to hear. Yeah, I mean, I caught glimpses of it while I was watching the Liverpool game, but made sure that right at the end I was tuned into the Villa game, because I thought, right, this is either a big celebration or a disaster as they throw it away. And Emi Martinez obviously stepped up, stood firm, I should say, rather than stepped up, and made two great stops towards the end that meant that Bayern weren't going to get that breakthrough. João Palhinha probably wishing he was back at Fulham, the way things are going for him so far at Bayern Munich. But yeah, fair play to Villa. Like, what a result. What a statement that is. Like, must be absolutely buzzing outside that stadium even now as everybody's leaving and we're recording this. Like, they will be... It's unbelievable, isn't it? Villa, not only in the Champions League, but going in and producing a result like that, we know that Villa have been playing well. We know that they've been good under Unai Emery. But two wins out of two in the Champions League, sixth in the Champions League as we look at it right now. It's a fantastic start for him. It's a huge achievement. But yeah, big shout out to obviously Emi Martinez, because like you say, Bayern Munich definitely haven't got the best goalkeeper, because Martinez, I'll tell you what, when it comes down to it, this is a guy you can count on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, he was brilliant throughout the game. You've mentioned those stops at the end, but he makes a really early one from Harry Kane. He tips an Elise with, you know, one of those ones that looks destined for the top corner over the bar towards the end of the first half. And, you know, those moments where Bayern did feel like they were in the ascendancy, it didn't feel like Villa were particularly perturbed by it in the fact that they knew that this was going to happen. I think Emery's game plan was to let Bayern have a lot of the ball and try to hit them in transition. That worked. There was a lot of 1v1 defending Watkins against Upamecano. And to be honest, he's a little bit lucky that he doesn't get sent off in the first half because he is last man. Now, Watkins is on the halfway line, but we know how quick Ollie Watkins is. He's away. And Upamecano pulls him down as he spins him. And I did see some interesting comments on Twitter, and nonetheless from our very own rank god Sam Tyre being like, that's a last man challenge. And I was like, not sure all the mans are deciding this given your innate biases in this game, but it was probably a little bit touch and go. Right. But I just thought that the way that this flipped, and look, Villa had to make some serious changes because they score the first goal of the game through Pau Torres, but it's offside because Jacob Ramsey is in a bad position. And to be honest, he shouldn't be where he is, but it is what it is.
By the way, that threw me massively because at the time I was only checking the scores on Live Score on my app and I'd seen Villa 1-0 up and I was like, whoa, I'd seen it just said 1-0. And then it was like, the goal happened like a bit before that as well. It wasn't like we were in the same minute. So I was like, well, and later on I check and it's like 0-0. I'm like, what? That totally threw me.
Yeah, it was a strange one. Then Ramsey goes off injured and they bring on Leon Bailey, who was dropped from the starting 11 for Jadon Philogene, who actually did really well. And I thought was excellent for lots of tonight. You kind of come onto that and then you think, okay, so where are Villa going? In the second half, I think that Unai Emery makes some of the smartest changes you will ever see. You know, there are these ways that this first half was like, Villa did grow into it 100%, but there was moments where you're starting to think, okay, is Leon Bailey going to give the same defensive acumen and work rate down that right-hand side as Jacob Ramsey did? And look, we know that Villa have been a little bit all over the place at fullback. Luca Dean, you know, and Ezri Konsa playing as a right-back meant Diego Carlos had to play through the middle. It's not ideal in so many kind of ways. But they get to that point and they start to make some really big changes. So John Duran is obviously the one that takes the headlines. We'll speak about him in a minute. But actually, there are these senses that Leon Bailey, after being subbed on, gets subbed off for Ian Maatsen. They start to squeeze the pitch a bit tighter. Whoa. Emery basically goes to this 4-4-2, which he uses nominally anyway, but it becomes really tight. Maatsen is the highest left-sided player, someone who's played left-back in a Champions League final. We're talking about a player who, you know, is very much left-back. They're almost tucking in there to not play for the draw, because we saw them do that, but to try and instigate the game into the way they wanted it. And Kompany spoke about the fact that he knew how dangerous Villa were in 1v1 situations. And yet he let his centre-backs go 1v1 with Morgan Rodgers and Ollie Watkins and then John Duran pretty much throughout. And maybe that's a sign of slight managerial tactical naivety that we saw. And Emery took full advantage of it. John Duran comes on. The place is going ballistic, right? 0-0. And you're talking about this moment at 70-odd minutes where John Duran comes onto the pitch and people just start to believe that he's going to do it again.
Superhero.
They just know that he's going to do it again. And suddenly it just goes off. And he gets this goal about 10 minutes after he comes on. It's really simple. It's a brilliant pass from Pau Torres to split the defense. But the finish is ludicrous. He's checked his shoulder once. I've just done it myself, coming away from the microphone, checking my shoulder. Checked his shoulder once as he's running onto this. He sees where Neuer is. He runs onto this ball and first time lifts it over him. A really powerful strike that we've become accustomed to with Duran.
Yeah.
But the wherewithal to know where he is on the pitch, to know where the goal is, to know where Neuer is, off one glance, is absolutely ridiculous. And you talk about superhero, that's 20/20 vision in so many ways. And he's able to execute as well. I mean, we know that the kid's going to be a star, but it just feels like one of those moments that he's already written himself into Villa folklore.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable story. I mean, at the moment, you're looking at John Duran being the kind of breakout star of this season. I mean, the impact that he's having is absolutely unbelievable. You know, you consider he's got 4 goals in 6 Premier League appearances so far this season. He ain't started a game yet. He ain't started a game. And he's come on here.
Wow, yeah, he did start against Wickham and he actually didn't play very well.
Yeah, he still scored in that game, though. So he scored in that game. Tonight comes on against Bayern Munich and scores. What's this guy got to do to start a game for Aston Villa? At what point do you say, actually, he's not going to, you know, there has to come a point where he's like, I am your best striker. And obviously you could make the argument, well, actually, no, you're our best impact striker. But
yeah.
We saw how much
this guy, 90-minute player.
Yeah, but we saw in the summer that Duran rates himself. We saw that he's got confidence. And by all accounts, he has been actually pretty professional since coming back in the summer. Villa have been very impressed from what I hear about how he's actually conducted himself and got his head straight. And obviously when he scored that goal against West Ham, Villa fans by that stage weren't even won over by him at all, but he's completely won him over now. I mean, they absolutely do not want this guy to go, but it's going to be hard to manage him because he's got to go and play somewhere. He's got to be in from the start soon. Extremely impressive that you can go and have this kind of impact on a team season. And Duran, who's only 20 years old, he's got the number 9 shirt and he is a proper number 9. And there are a lot of clubs out there now who, even if they weren't looking at him in the summer, will now be looking at him.
Yeah, I mean, the reports out of Villa that 40 clubs made an approach for John Duran in the summer. That's what Monchi says anyway. But it's interesting listening to different things. I mean, look, there's a brilliant article on The Athletic, and it's not just because I spoke to Jacob earlier, but it's about John Duran and the way that he settled in. And he spoke to Monchi about him, and the kind of, Monchi has a daughter who's older than John Duran. And you're kind of looking at him going, okay, that's interesting. And he feels like he's got a real duty of care almost to this young man. It's a brilliant article. I highly, highly recommend you go and read it. But just another moment to add to his lists of just brilliance this season. And I'm still not completely convinced that he is the player to kind of start games. Obviously, he's going to want to start more than he currently is. But equally, there is a line here of being like, obviously a pathway for you to become one of the world's best. Right now, what you're doing is you're getting these moments, you're getting these minutes, and you're taking your chances when they come, you know, when they come around. That's okay for a little while. I mean, it's not going to be okay for 3 years. But at this point in his career, I do think that that is important for him to be able to just manage that and make sure that expectations don't go completely through the roof. Because, you know, he has time on his side and currently he's in a really good place in terms of goal scoring form, but also in terms of a manager who clearly does believe in him as well.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I would just throw him in from the start against Man United. If there's ever going to be a time to give someone, you know, if you've got a point to prove, you want to be doing it against Man United because it's still considered a scalp. It still really motivates you as much as any fixture in football. And Man United are not going to be able to handle him. So that's clearly given Emery something to think about. And imagine Watkins then coming on as sub saying, no way is he having my shirt. And then coming on to try and prove a point against Man United. I think Unai Emery has got himself into a very nice position here, actually, when it comes to selection headaches.
Yeah, I would agree. All right, we've got loads to get through, so we're going to have to keep moving on today's episode. The fact that they've added more games into the Champions League means these are going to be a little bit more rushed than perhaps usual, but we'll do our very best. I want to talk about the two Madrid clubs, both of them beaten after what was clearly a draining derby at the weekend, but a massive result for Lille beating reigning champions Real Madrid 1-0. Now, we do know that Real Madrid have form for not potentially pulling out their best performances in the knockout stage, in the group stages, and saving them for those knockout stages. But they were incredibly lackluster, Real Madrid. It was a really strange one. The only goal of the game is a penalty, which Jonathan David converts beautifully, by the way, absolutely gorgeously. Handball from Eduardo Camavinga, who came back into the side tonight. It was a strange one. I was just reading that it was 36 games since Real Madrid lost in any competition, which was back in the Copa del Rey, which they lost to Atleti in January. But actually, they hadn't lost in the Champions League since May 2023, which was to Manchester City in the semi-final. I just thought that they looked all over the place. And I don't know if that is just an element of tiredness. I don't know if it was an element of the way that they set up, not sort of feeling like a halfway house between what they've been doing this season and what they did last season. Valverde kind of nominally played on the right wing. Vinicius played off the left. Endrick got his first start, became Real Madrid's youngest ever Champions League star. And he looked all right, to be fair to him. He looked sharp enough. He pressed really well, but didn't find that kind of magic touch. Equally, no one else did around him. Bellingham looked off the pace. Danny Carvajal looked really weirdly off the pace. They brought Mbappe on sort of late on. He didn't seem to be able to find that extra gear to inspire them either. And Lille did the job that was in front of them. And I think this is the kind of thing. And you look at what they're trying to do and you think about some of these players. And we've talked about him before, but I just wanted to give a shout out to Thiago Santos, who basically stands up Vinicius Jr. all game. And then Mbappe comes on. He stands up Kylian Mbappe. He stands his ground and he shuts both of them down. That is some performance in this competition against this Real Madrid side. For this youngster from Lille, who you know, both of us rate really highly, we've spoken about him being someone that people are looking at in terms of long-term options at right back, but I thought he was phenomenal here. And just in terms of every time you saw one of those big Real Madrid stars get on the ball, he was the man out. And he was also the man who ends up clearing the ball off the line in the dying minutes to preserve this win as well. So big, big result for Lille, but really, really lackluster from Real Madrid.
Yeah, and Thiago Santos really is not going to be at Lille much longer, surely. But then again, I thought this about Jonathan David, and I can't believe he's still there, still scoring goals for them in the Champions League and scoring one that decides a match against Real Madrid, who are forced to bring on pretty much the best player in the world, Kylian Mbappe, from the bench for half an hour. And he can't do it. If you think of what Lille
Essentially pushing him back from injury a little bit early, they probably wouldn't have wanted to use him tonight if they didn't have to. And they did. And he looked like a player coming back from injury.
Mate, they've ended the game, Lille, up against Mbappe, Vinicius Jr., Jude Bellingham, Valverde, Arda Güler, Luka Modric has come on, Tchouameni stayed on. Like, unbelievable that they've managed to stand up to that, because, you know, the great thing about Real Madrid in this competition, as we know, is that they're kind of, they just find a way. They're a bit relentless. They've got the magic formula. So any win at any time against Real Madrid is special. And this one particularly cannot be overlooked. I know that it's a difficult format to get our heads around right now. We don't really know what it means to lose these Champions League games at this stage. Possibly nothing, but possibly it does. Like, this seems like a bit of a setback to me.
I think it's interesting to see how many lackluster performances we've seen from Real Madrid. Now, they're only 3 points behind Barcelona at the top of La Liga, right? But actually, they've now dropped 3 points here. They weren't great against Stuttgart, although they pulled out the win in very classic Real Madrid style in that first game. Next up, they have Borussia Dortmund in a rerun of last year's final, a final which I think a lot of us agreed they were slightly the inferior side for a lot of. Then they have AC Milan, who are a bit all over the place, and we'll talk about a bit later. And then Liverpool. Like, that's a really difficult run of games. You lose one or two more of them. And look, we're not saying that Real Madrid are not going to be in the knockout stage. It's just ludicrous. But suddenly you go from the team who are champions, you assume they were going to be top seed, second seed. You lose another one of these and Real Madrid will end up seventh seeds or something. Mm. Now, will they be able to win from there? Almost certainly, fine. But like, the point is that this is not the all-dominant and completely in control side that we saw for long periods of last year. Mm. They still haven't found this balance yet this season, and I'm going to keep banging on about it until it stops.
No, it's fair enough, mate. I mean, I obviously just say they'll be fine because that's all I've seen for most of my lifetime. But you're right to say that this doesn't look great, because it doesn't. And if you were an alien landing on the planet right now, there would be no reason to believe that this is a team that's going to win domestic or European honours. And yet, they'll potentially win both. So
they probably will.
Let's just wait and see what happens. I mean,
that's just what they do. I mean, look, it could be worse for Madrid. They could be Atletico Madrid because they lost 4-0 to Benfica. And my thoughts really aren't that much about Atleti, because Atleti have been pretty dreadful away from home in Europe for quite some time now. This isn't necessarily new. Although they looked really lackluster, really tired in this one. They didn't get any of that aggression going. A couple of key players left on the bench. Julian Alvarez is not meshing right with the way that Simeone wants him to play yet. And I think that's quite obvious. But Conor Gallagher left out of this one, and they really did lack his industry in the middle. My point's more about Benfica, because the last few weeks I've been watching Sporting and saying there's absolutely no chance that anyone else wins the title in Portugal this year. But perhaps there could be a title race after all, because Benfica have had this new lease of life under Bruno Lage. And to be honest, he has form for this. The last time he took over at Benfica. He took them from miles back in the Primeira and his, you know, to end up romping home to that title. And I do think suddenly we've got life in Lisbon. He's balanced the midfield. He's brought in Frederic Arsenez in there alongside Florentino Luis and Erkan Kokcu, who looks excellent at the moment, which is nice to see. But in doing so, he's really freed up this front three to just sort of run riot. Arturoglu looks ludicrously good at the moment. And we knew that when he signed for Benfica, there was a real player in there, someone that was able to do things. But he is playing like a demon. And Di Maria on the other flank looks ageless, right? He just drips class. And he just keeps doing these incredible crossfield passes that open teams up for Benfica. And then in the middle, Vangelis Pavlidis, who came in the summer from AZ Alkmaar, looks every inch the top level striker that he was kind of threatening to be, even on the brink at RZ and what he was doing there. So loads to like about this Benfica resurgence. They really do feel like they are trouble for teams. And although Atleti were very bad here, and that must be taken into account, it's still Atletico Madrid at home. And that is now 5 wins in a row for Benfica. Now, they made the first one a little bit difficult against Red Star. They were 2-0 up and cruising and conceded late. This was a demolition. They hammered Gil Vicente and Boavista in the Primeira and also beat Santa Clara in Bruno Lage's first game in. So 5 wins in 5 games since coming with some very impressive results in there. And it's really nice to see a lot of this team just having that balance again, really starting to see that with the amount of talent in this Benfica team, they should have been there. It feels like they might be getting somewhere in terms of pushing for that title this season.
Yeah, I have to say, I am looking forward to watching all the extended highlights later today. And this one's going to be one of the first ones that I get stuck into, because the thing that stuck out to me when I like saw the scoreline and I dug straight into the lineup to see like what he'd done here. And by the start of the second half, he's made 4 substitutions. And when you see that Llorente, Griezmann, Koke, Rodrigo de Pau have all been taken off by the time the second half is starting, you know that Simeone is absolutely raging with what he's seeing in front of him, or they've got an absolute injury crisis on their hands. And so I'm excited to see actually how this fell apart. The substitutions obviously haven't helped at all, because you know, 7 minutes into the second half, they're 2-0 down, and then late on, Benfica put the nails in the coffin and it's done. 4-0 does not make good reading. And I'll tell you what, there aren't many times that you'll see Atletico Madrid getting beaten by this sort of scoreline. Interestingly, at the end of last season, they did actually, Osasuna done them 4-1. But there's not many times that I can remember this team getting turned over heavily. It's interesting because when things do go badly, though, for them, when things don't flow, like, it's not great. Like, let's roll our minds back to last season. Obviously, Champions League quarterfinals up against Borussia Dortmund, a game that Atletico Madrid are expecting to win. They conceded 4 goals that day as well, actually. 4-2 they ended up losing to Borussia Dortmund. So these glitches do happen for Simeone teams. It's obviously fuming when it does happen, but they tend to recover. That's I guess, the one good thing about Atletico Madrid. They don't tend to have long spells of defeats. In fact, you really...
Simeone won't accept it.
Yeah, I mean, you occasionally see back-to-back defeats. You will... I can't think of a time, to be honest, see 3 defeats in a row for an Atletico Madrid team. So they'll be looking to immediately bounce back, because this is... It's a really, really bad result.
That's a thumping.
It's a thumping.
That's a real thumping.
It is.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about Liverpool?
Yeah, Liverpool won. They won 2-0. Arne Slot said before this game that they haven't come up against a good team yet, and they still haven't. Pretty convincing win for Liverpool. A couple of dodgy moments in there, which I will address as well, but ultimately McAllister and Mo Salah, 1 goal in each half, has given Liverpool what was and looks like a comfortable win in the Champions League. That's 2 out of 2 after also beating AC Milan. So everything rosy for Arne Slot right now. Let's just...
First Liverpool manager to win 8 of his 9 first games in charge.
Yeah, it's great. You see people looking at the starts of the season in other teams and say, well, you know, he's new to it, or he hasn't had his own signings, he hasn't had this, he hasn't had that. And there's Arne Slot, one signing, doing even better than Jurgen Klopp.
One signing who's gone back out on loan.
Well, they got Chiesa. But yeah, so I think there's two interesting things for me coming away from this game, because it was a pretty convincing display in there. They all were pretty much a 7 out of 10 performances, right? But is Darwin Nunez ever going to actually fit in under Arne Slot? That is honestly a big thing coming out of this. He didn't have a good game here. I tweeted when he got subbed, like for about 3 minutes before he gets subbed, he keeps looking over at the touchline. He knows his time's coming. That moment had been coming since about the half hour mark, to be honest. Nunez off, Jota on. The most predictable thing.
He did finish a chance. He was offside, but he did finish a chance really well. I'll give him some credit.
Like, he was offside. There's one chance offside when he shouldn't have been. His hold up play wasn't good enough. There was a moment when, in the second half, it was actually just before he was substituted, and he just lets a moment pass. And Arne Slot, the camera kind of cuts him. He was furious. He like waved his arm in the air. And I can't tell this for sure because I wasn't at the game and I couldn't tell what he was directing at. But he turns around and it's not long after that the Jota comes on. It was like he's seen enough, like Nunez is coming off. Yeah, I'm not sure what really happened with Darwin Nunez, but it's not looking great for him at the moment. And it wouldn't surprise me if things carry on like this, if this turns out to be his last season at Liverpool, if I'm totally honest. But that's the story for another day. I just think it's interesting. This was a good opportunity for him in a game where he really could have done with coming away with not just a goal, but a positive performance. He hasn't done that. I mean, Liverpool crowd being Liverpool crowd gave him an ovation as he came off. They're going to continue to support him. They still love him. But I am interested to see what happens with that. Generally, look, Liverpool was sharper. Arne Slot had been looking for his team to get up and going better from the off. And I think that they did that. Gravenberch was great.
Better second half by all accounts, I think.
Mate, there are just times when Gravenberch just does stuff on the ball and I'm just like, mate, you are so, so sharp. His mind is so sharp. Obviously, we talked about him on the main episode this week, but yeah, Gravenberch continues to impress. And the one thing that I'll say about Liverpool, and Bologna were clearly like targeting this, is that the only time I really see them vulnerable is when there's a ball. And I'm not, look, Liverpool aren't the only team that are vulnerable to this. It's a tried and tested thing in football. But the balls that go in between their defence and goalkeeper, there is always a mistake to be made. That is like six times.
Followed by a very high press, right? I thought that was interesting too.
Yeah, and 5-6 times we saw Bologna try to get in those positions. And on another day, could easily have come out here with a point that wouldn't have really deserved. But we've seen a couple of times this season, Liverpool kind of being forced into mistakes that lead to goals, but they're from similar areas. And it is seeming to me that one of the only ways you're going to score against Liverpool is to just either get out wide and try and pull the ball back in between the defence and the goalkeeper when there's not a lot of space there, and it either goes in off the defender or you get a striker in there to finish it off, or there's a dinked ball in behind over the top that kind of just catches them in no man's land and wondering who's going to come for it, the goalkeeper or the defender. This isn't the only game I've seen that be a slight problem for Liverpool. So it's something to watch out for going forward. But generally, like, there's nothing really here to take away except that Liverpool are purring.
Yeah, I mean, you can hassle and harry, and I think Bologna tried their best, but ultimately quality told, and I wonder if Liverpool would have been able to step it up. It almost felt like when they went 1-0 up, they just sat off the gas a little bit, and I thought that was interesting. It's very not Klopp, but we've also complimented them for being calm this season, so I'm not 100% sure where I sit on it yet. Yeah, so we'll see.
Fine.
We'll
there
see, but so far so good,
sure,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, right, let's round up the rest of them, but I think we have to start this round up with Juventus, who won 3-2 at RB Leipzig. And my overarching, overwhelming takeaway from this is, have this new Juventus got some spirit or what? Like I said, obviously, that Bremer was the most important player to this Juve side, the rock on which the defense is built. So when he walks off with injury, and so does Nico Gonzalez, who is the kind of player who can make things happen in on a sixpence, this is their first real test. Then they go behind for the first time this season. You're like, wow, we'll see the measure of them now. They equalize and you're like, okay, cool. They've got a bit about them. Then they go down to 10 men. Michel Degorio is sent off. What have they got? You know, the keeper that they've brought in to basically be the new staple, he gets sent off. They go behind again and then they pull out this win with 10 men. Unbelievable goal from Vlahovic for the second equalizer. And an even better one, I think, from Chico Conceição for the win. He drifts into the box, beats two men, tucks it in, and then they go full old school Juve, 10 men behind the ball. They absolutely hassle and harry until the very, very last minute of this one. And yes, Leipzig have a couple of chances at the end, but good goalkeeping from Perrin, who comes in. They were brilliant. And they were even more brilliant when they went down to 10 men, because actually in the first half, I thought the Leipzig had the better of this one and they actually looked like they were able to pull Juve out of shape. So to be able to do what they did in the second half of this game, got to give all props to Juventus. I thought it was going to be a real test for them generally. This is one of their first big games, I think, of the season, but also in terms of the situation going behind for the first time, it's interesting to see how teams respond to that. They responded. They responded big style. And Vlahovic, after a lot of criticism recently, put this team on his shoulders, obviously scored the first two goals, and then is just everywhere. Is pushing, is pressing, is doing all of what he's required to do. This was very, very impressive from Juventus, and they deserve massive credit.
Yeah, again, this is one of the ones that I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into in a bit and actually watching this one back. Obviously, it reads great on paper, but it sounds like it was genuinely a really good game as well. We've been waiting for a really, really interesting Juventus game. They obviously have been a better watch this season anyway, but this is the sort of match I want them to be involved in and kind of really test them in terms of resilience as well as technical power. So yeah, it sounds like a really good one now.
It's the first game they really haven't been like dominant in, especially in terms of possession, etc. They haven't just completely controlled it. Yes, there have been games where they haven't scored, but this was their first big test in terms of lots of things, and they have passed with flying colours. So yeah, shout out Juve. Couple more. Dinamo Zagreb played two-all draw with Monaco at the Maximir. This was a sickener. Dinamo 2-0 up. Two brilliant goals, by the way. The surface was so wet. So wet, you could barely move the ball. But Martin Batarina dancing around, the heir to Luka Modric, they're calling him in Croatia. It's brilliant. And Petr Sucic scores a brilliant, brilliant first goal. Sends his man for a hot dog and chips the keeper. He's a defensive midfielder. I'm telling you, Croatia's midfield is in good, good hands. They're going to be absolutely fine. But Monaco dug it out. Fair play to them. 2-0 down. Horrible place to be playing. Not only the atmosphere incredibly intimidating, but also actually the conditions in this were not great. So fair play to Monaco pulling out a result after looking like they were pretty much dead and buried at the Maximir. Fair play. Sturm Graz lost 1-0 to Club Brugge. Sturm Graz aren't very good, but this is an absolutely ridiculous goal to win this. Former Norwich City man, Christos Solis. Shades of that Kenan Yildiz goal for Juventus on the last match day. Mm-hmm. Cuts in from the left. Curls an absolute beauty into the top corner. To be honest, Duran will get the headlines, but this is my shout for goal of the match week, to be honest. Girona lost 3-2 to Feyenoord at home. I can't wait for you to watch this. One of the maddest, most ridiculous games of football you will ever see. Three own goals. One of them's ruled out. Two missed penalties. Late drama. One of the goals is like kickabout at the park level. Donny van der Beek actually ends up scoring it, but it's genuinely playground football. Girona can't defend. They look incredibly open through the middle. Alex Garcia's obviously gone to Leverkusen. Oriol Romeu, who came in or back in, he was injured for this one. Dali Blind, they looked a little bit lost without that leadership in the middle, but a really, really just mad game. If you go and watch the highlights of, well, go and watch the highlights of all of these, but this one in particular, I think might have got lost in the mix. Don't let it be. It was really, truly ludicrous in pretty much every sense. And then Atalanta beat Shakhtar 3-0. Nice and comfy from an Atalanta perspective. They started this competition really well. They played very, very well in that game against Arsenal. They should have won with the missed penalty. But actually, this was super comfortable. Some really impressive work from Charles Ketelaere down the middle. Ademola Lookman back on the score sheet. Looks like he's put his strop behind him and decided that he's just going to get back at it with Atalanta. And good result for them to round things off.
Well done, mate. Right. Well done.
There you go. That's everything Wednesday. Come back, we'll do Tuesday's action. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to Ranks FC. This is Champions League Takeaway, and it's time for us to talk about the 9 games that happened on Monday. Dean, going to start us off at the Emirates, where Arsenal got their first big scalp, I would say, since 2015. They beat Bayern Munich in the Champions League in 2015. Since then, in this competition, I don't think there's anything you would recognize as a big team or a big European giant that Arsenal have gone and won against. They won that night with goals from Olivier Giroud and Mesut Ozil, which shows you how far ago it was. But this was very impressive.
Well, the problem is, though, it doesn't feel like a scalp. They don't feel like a European giant because PSG really weren't very good. They didn't pose a threat. And I think that that's the biggest surprise coming away from it for me. It was interesting yesterday, obviously, coming off the back of this game, we recorded another episode of Ranks for the main feed. And you're like, oh, how did PSG do? And I was really like struggling to find words for actually what they'd done because I was like, well, they didn't play bad, but hang on, they didn't actually do anything. And I was looking at it in a bit closer. I was like, you look at the stats, Arsenal had 35% possession. You're like, that's weird because it felt really comfortable. And you start to realize that all that really happened in the game is that, well, you can have 65% of possession, but it doesn't matter if you don't do anything with it. And that's what it felt like for PSG. For most of this game, they didn't have really a target. They didn't have like a route to goal. And it just felt strange that this would be their approach to a match against Arsenal, who obviously have a great defence as it is. I've said on the main feed about David Raya and how highly I rate him this week. But it wasn't until Kolo Muani came on with like 25 minutes left that you felt that there was any intent in the PSG team. So to start with, I'll say like, well done, Arsenal. This is a really good win. But they didn't really have to do anything much to win it because all they did was let PSG have the ball. And then they knew that once they won it back, they could use their superior quality to create chances and hopefully finish them. Havertz takes his goal pretty well, maybe some questionable goalkeeping. Saka takes his free kick.
It's still a good finish. It is questionable goalkeeping. It's still a good finish.
Still a good finish. Saka scores his weird free kick. And yeah, it's questionable goalkeeping. But at the same time, it's such a difficult free kick to defend. Like the way that Saka whips that in, it's so tough for the goalkeeper. And obviously people say he's at fault, Donnarumma. He doesn't cover himself in glory, but like, the way it's whipped, the where it bounces, the bodies it goes through, it's so hard to stop. I guess the best thing about this for Arsenal was that they could pretty much stroll through it and build on those late goals against Leicester and just keep building confidence towards what their objectives are for this season. But ultimately, I mean, we talked recently about how you had PSG as potential dark horses in this competition, if there was to be a dark horse of this kind of status. But you watch a game like this and be like, well, they're going to be absolutely nowhere near it because they haven't got any threat. I don't understand what their game plan was here against one of the best sides in Europe for Luis Enrique to come in thinking he's still managing Barcelona. Like, you're not, mate. You have to have an actual goal threat. And they're miles off it. They're miles off it because they did not have a route to goal until Kolo Muani came on, and even then it was too late.
Yeah, it's a strange one because obviously Gonzalo Ramos got injured and he was very much kind of seen as Luis Enrique's preferred number nine. Mm. He doesn't seem to trust Kolo Muani for whatever reason. He's played Asensio in that role. He played Lee in there, Kangin Lee against Arsenal. It really didn't work.
No Dembele, obviously. He didn't play him. So.
No Dembele, which was due to, you know, him not working hard enough for the team. And I can appreciate Luis Enrique's stance on these things. It just felt like Arsenal were physically overmatched here. And it kind of felt in some ways, having watched it back today, that they were playing two different sports. Like, it almost felt like two different variations of football. One of which was, yes, kind of this watered down version of positional play, juega de posición, that Luis Enrique likes. And the other, which was Arsenal just been like, well, if you're going to do that, we're going to bully you. And there is this thing, there is a potential issue in PSG's midfield, as brilliant as they are, and as much as I love them and love watching them, that in a game like this, they can just be physically dominated. And they were, right? They just felt like they were just unable to keep up that, you know, pretense alongside this Arsenal midfield. And at times, Arsenal was so happy to sit off them. And then when it mattered in transition, it was almost like running through them.
Yeah.
And so I do wonder if this is just an early iteration. I still think PSG will get better. I'm willing to double down on that prediction when when Barkala gets into games, this is a very young PSG team, right? We're talking about João Neves and Warren Zaïre-Emery, who are both under the age of 20. Vitinha is the senior man in this midfield. He's what, 24? You're looking at two wingers here who are under the age of 21. You're looking at Kangin Lee, who is not a striker, moonlighting there. I think that PSG will get better, but this one felt like Arsenal were very, very heavily overmatched.
Yeah, and the annoying slash stupid thing is that in the hours that have passed since this game, I've started to see a few pundits say, well, what do you expect when you sell all your superstars? What do you expect when you get rid of players like Mbappe and don't replace them? It's like, that's not what this is, though. That's not...
No, that's not the point.
That's
the
not
point
it.
Is, like, this is a Look, Luis Enrique spoke about it. He said, we're further back in our project now than Arsenal are. They've had a couple of years building up on this. We've just got started, but I believe in the direction we're going. And you know,
they have to stick with that. Like, think what Arsenal were in the early days of Arteta and what he was trying to build and how... You know, it's taken him, 3 years to get here?
PSG are ahead of that, let's be clear.
I think so. Yeah, exactly. So you just got to sometimes have some patience and accept that you learn the lessons from, you know, you're playing one of literally the best teams in Europe. I would expect Arsenal to get to at least quarterfinals this season, but possibly semis.
Especially at home, right?
Yeah,
one of those really interesting ones. PSG are going to be absolutely fine. Let's come on to Borussia Dortmund 7, Celtic 1. This was a tough watch in many ways. Brendan Rodgers said it afterwards.
Well, if you're a Celtic fan.
It was difficult viewing. I imagine that Rangers fans would have been absolutely loving it and completely fair play. But
I was,
you look
mate.
At
yeah.
Oh, yeah, here he is. Rangers.
I'm not a Rangers fan. I only pretend it.
But also, Brendan Rodgers spoke about this and he was like, yes, we made mistakes. And they did. And Celtic were at fault for a couple of these goals by just overplaying around the back and not getting there. There's also this kind of sense that every mistake they made was punished in a way that you just so rarely see in football. Karim Adeyemi in the first half of this game was absolutely unplayable. It was ridiculous. The second and third goals he scored, the second from sort of the edge of the area on the angle, lashes it home past Kasper Schmeichel. Yes, positioning slightly questionable, but you do not expect him to score from that kind of range. And the third one, he just picks up on the edge and he's clearly just feeling himself. He unleashes a rocket into the near corner from just on the edge of the box. And you're thinking, hang on, Karim Adeyemi scored 5 goals in all competitions last year. Where on earth has this come from? Mm. So there are mitigating circumstances for Celtic. Cameron Carter-Vickers being absent felt massive. Austin Trusty, definitely not good enough yet. Whether he gets there or not is a different question. But right now, that is a massive step down. And I think it affected Liam Scales as well. They just didn't feel comfortable at any point in the defensive unit. They left way too much space for Jamie Gittins and Adeyemi to get in behind and hurt them. And then Serge Gyarassi was just knocking around for when things did get short. He started to play these really little intricate pocket plays that he ends up scoring his second goal from. But Borussia Dortmund were excellent. Like, absolutely sensational. A real shame for Adeyemi that he got sent off. He got injured at the start of the second half because honestly, he could have had 6 or 7. He just, everything he touched seemed to be working perfectly. Mm. And it was a really mad start, obviously. They give away a penalty, they concede, they score like a minute later, and then they concede again a minute after that, after Dortmund start to bypass the high press. But this was a real wake-up call for Celtic that ultimately, and Brendan Rodgers said afterwards, he's not going to change his style, the style that's made them so dominant in, you know, domestic affairs, and that's fine. But ultimately, you have to start to be able to adapt. And I think that we've seen from, you know, Arsenal over the years, but also Bayer Leverkusen this season, that actually what happens with great teams is if you want to start to step that up onto the next stage, you really do need to learn how to adapt things differently. It's a youngish Celtic team with some new members in the midfield. It didn't fit and it didn't click yesterday, and they were absolutely punished to the nines for it. But equally, it is also one of those nights where just everything Dortmund seemed to touch went in.
Yeah. I mean, look, this has been the story of Celtic in Europe, really, hasn't it? I mean, they're having a good season. There's no doubt about it. And Brendan's obviously won a lot of people
not
over.
Not conceded a goal in the league, I don't think.
Yeah, exactly. So, but they've had some hide-ins in Europe. And I just probably hoping they could avoid that, like just avoid being whipping boys, and especially in this format, like just give yourself some hope of having a decent goal difference, not getting,
I think Celtic will actually be fine in terms of getting the playoffs, just because they have young boys still to play. I think they have Dinamo Zagreb, who, you know, were good tonight, but there are a couple of games there that you think you look at for Celtic and think, yeah, they're winnable, maybe a way to Atalanta next isn't
I'm going to say, the problem is their next two are Atalanta and I think it's Leipzig. So
once that's out of the way, Celtic's kind of home straight is okay.
Is it? Okay.
So I do think that actually they'll be all right, although it's not going to lead to much beyond the playoffs, I would imagine, on this kind of form. But maybe they will take this away and learn and actually build on it. It's you know, one of those ones that you need to look back at and decide how it works and how you're going to try and counteract that against such quality, because that's what this competition is.
Yeah, absolutely. Mate, shall I take us on to another game?
Shall we go to Milan? Actually, to Leverkusen.
To Leverkusen. Leverkusen 1, AC Milan 0. Victor Boniface scores the only goal. Pretty upsetting for AC Milan that they're two games into the Champions League, two defeats, and haven't really got going. And I think you come away from it being feeling like, are this side going to be good enough? Okay, they've had a really difficult start compared to a lot of teams. To have played Liverpool and Bayer Leverkusen after the first two games in a new format of this tournament is...
They're on the Xabi Alonso tour.
Yeah.
They've got Real Madrid in a couple of weeks as well.
Pretty tough luck. And they struggled to get into this game. And it was no surprise at all once Boniface did score. He'd already had the ball in the back of the net once and it was ruled out. The second one, they couldn't rule out, even though there was slight doubt at one point if he might have been offside in the build-up. But yeah, it took Milan a good hour to get going. And in the end, they possibly could have got a draw out of it, but I don't think, to be honest, they might claim. Yeah, I don't think they deserved a draw. I think they might be able to argue that what they put in at the back end of the game deserved something. But you can't not turn up for an hour against Bayer Leverkusen and get away with it most of the time is the ultimate story of the game. Now,
they had Mike Maignan to thank for being 1-0 down rather than 3-0 down. And I think that ultimately is the story of the night.
They did, yeah. And there's, you know, that's the probably the biggest takeaway from the game is that they were saved by their goalkeeper, which to be fair is literally his job. But
best keeper in the world, mate.
But the other thing I was going to say is that obviously on the main pod this week, I talk about Pulisic being Milan's most important player. And you said, well, the thing is, he's backed up because of Chukwueze. I tell you what, I've got an argument. He ain't a good backup. He is not turning up, mate. Again and again, we're just not seeing the best of this guy. He's a real letdown again here. And this is not a new narrative with Chukwueze. Whether he fails to beat his man or whether he just wastes a cross or wastes an opportunity in a good space, it's really, really frustrating. And you can't really have that anymore, AC Milan. Like, they've come to a place where they can't have passengers. They need him to come into the game and have actual impact. And it wouldn't surprise... If he carries on like this, I honestly don't think he'll be at the club much longer. It sounds like I'm just trying to get rid of players here. I'm trying to get rid of Darwin Nunez, now trying to get rid of Chukwueze. Sorry to be all negative, but I just...
They're all coming to Fulham.
Yeah, coming both to Fulham. I was just surprised that he was given an opportunity to make an impact here, even though it's only 10 minutes at the end of the game. It's up for grabs, right? You're coming on for Pulisic, the guy whose shirt you basically want. And their opportunity is there, still 1-0. And he just couldn't take it. On the flip side of it, like, Leverkusen obviously are a very good team. And just to end by talking about Boniface, because I tweeted about him while I was watching this game, just saying what a menace he is and that I'd love to see him in the Prem, basically. And a lot of people were like, well, he's already ruled it out. And I was like, okay, so let's think of what Boniface said. He was asked if he would like to play in the Premier League one day, right? And he said, no, I've been saying this even before I had an international passport, even before I dreamed of coming to Europe. I don't really like the Premier League. I prefer Spanish and German football. I do not believe for one second that if Chelsea follow up their interest in Victor Boniface, that he is not going to come to the Premier League. And if he does, I'm seriously questioning why not. Does he not fancy it? Does he not back himself to thrive in the league? Does he think that
maybe
Germany...
Maybe it doesn't matter the weather, mate.
If it's about the weather, then I totally get it. Just say that. And I agree. That's why I'm not in England either.
Yeah, that's why you left.
But, you know, Spain and Germany just sounds to me like... You have the potential there to not be...
They're not similar football cultures either.
Similar football cultures.
Maybe he's just angling for a move for Real Madrid or Barcelona.
Yeah, that doesn't really make any sense why those two leagues. Germany, obviously, like, you're already, like, you're already eating it up, so that's fine.
You've done the business there, yeah.
Yeah, but to go to Spain, well, yeah, you're obviously talking about you're going to be at one of three or four clubs, in which case, of course, you should score loads more goals. I just find it a bit weird, and I'll be totally honest, I don't believe him. I don't believe that if the opportunity came to go to the Premier League that he wouldn't come. And I think that the way that he's playing... Look, Leverkusen, he's brilliant, mate. He's so good. Like, I love this style of striker. I love the positions he makes. I love the intensity of his runs and the desire that he shows to get on the end of crosses. And I want him to have a desire to get to the Premier League because I want to see more of him.
Nah, I hope he stays away. I've had enough Prem faces down the years. I hope he stays well away and enjoys his time instead. It's going to be an interesting one. But yeah, he's absolutely brilliant. And I like it. I saw him described, I think it was in Scouted last year, as a number nine with the soul of a winger. And it really got me. Thought it was a really lovely description. The last thing I'll add on this, Leverkusen, excellent. And they've obviously adapted and they went a little bit defensive here towards the end of things. And look, Milan maybe could and maybe should have scored. But you kind of look at it and think at how Xabi Alonso is trying to evolve and adapt to that Leverkusen side. And I'm really intrigued by how it plays out from here, because he's clearly seen their defensive line as a slight issue over the first pieces of this season, but also maybe at the back end of last. And he's just trying to change things up a bit to try and be more competitive in this kind of competition. And I think that's important in terms of just helping this side to continue evolving, because standing still is going backwards, right?
Yeah.
That is a good thing. The only other thing is that Milan ultras and Milan fans are pretty disappointed with this, which is fair enough. You're allowed to be disappointed. You can't be like holding this against him, Paolo Fonseca. He's gone away to the German champions. And okay, Milan haven't been absolutely brilliant, but easily they've only lost 1-0 to the team that romped home, lost one game all season last year. That is not a dreadful result in the context of Milan's season. There are lots of things you can be potentially angry at Paolo Fonseca at. This is not one of them. So let's just put that one.
And they were loving Fonseca at the weekend when they were battering. I know it was only Lecce, but like that goal blitz that they had at the weekend in the first half. There was some lovely stuff there.
Winning the derby, these things matter, right?
Exactly. Yeah, they just come through a good spell, exactly.
Exactly. Let's go on to Barcelona, who won 5-0 at Young Boys. And look, again, pinch of salt, all of those things. Really just impressive for Barcelona to bounce back in this manner, right? And obviously the first team restored to the starting lineup, but just pretty much everything yesterday was positive from a Barcelona perspective. They're still a little bit easy to cut open on the break, but Frenkie de Jong returning from injury, his first game since April, massive, I think, in the context of Barcelona's season and the fact that they have so many midfielders out at the moment, that feels like a big, big boost to the way that Barcelona are going to want to play and want to kind of move going forward. A little bit rusty, but to be expected at this point. We saw Lamine Yamal doing Lamine Yamal things once again, and Lewandowski breaking more records, becoming just the second player, I think, to score 10 Champions League goals for three sides behind Cristiano Ronaldo. He's done it for Dortmund and Bayern and Barcelona now, and also entering a club with Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo about scoring goals after his 30th birthday in the Champions League. So shout out to Robert Lewandowski. Hansi Flick got the result he needed here. He made those changes at the weekend to freshen them up so that they could be back in for this game, and it all went perfectly. Barcelona back in the conversation. Really good, just basic and simple, and did lots of nice things. Do you have anything for City? Again, routine, it felt.
It was pretty routine, yeah. I mean, I guess the biggest thing to take away from it is Phil Foden back amongst it. He's got man of the match. And now you wonder if this the elevation that's going to kind of kick him on and kick City on from this season. There were some nice moments in the game. McAtee comes on and scores a goal. He's been waiting for his chances at Man City. Local player who's could easily have left in the summer. Teams like Celtic were looking at him, and he's backed himself. And there's a kind of a feeling that he's already better than being at a club like Celtic. Sorry, Jack. But McAtee comes into this game for Man City against Slaven Bratislava, and he kind of takes it all in his stride. He rounds off the scoring to make it 4-0 after Haaland, Foden and Gundogan have already scored. Gundogan put in a really, really good performance. So, by the way, did Rico Lewis. Rico Lewis was absolutely superb again for Man City, and Pep was crowing about him afterwards. again as well. It was very easy. I mean, Haaland literally looked like he couldn't be bothered to be there after time, if I'm totally honest. It literally looked like it was a punishment to have to play in a match like this, but he still scored, so he was happy enough as he left.
His record goes on, 42 goals in 41 Champions League games now. It's not bad, is it?
It's not bad at all, is it? But yeah, this was obviously always going to be a routine win as expected for Man City. I guess the only surprise, Mateus Nunes started and finished the game for Man City, and it's a big opportunity for him. I didn't think he played that well, to be honest. And I felt like, of all the players...
I think they're just getting used to him still.
Maybe.
Like, he's so different, and the way that he drives through the midfield
I don't know what he does. I don't know where he's supposed to be or what role he's supposed to fill. And I haven't really understood that since he signed, if I'm totally honest. I don't know that I would even be the only one who feels that way, but I just don't know if he's ever going to fit in at Man City. Obviously a really good player, but...
I don't think his traits are all that cut out for them. No. But equally, I can see, you know, maybe the advantage of having a player who is so good in those areas, who can drive through the midfield, who can open up teams, maybe better teams than Slovan Bratislava, who are obviously going to sit a little bit deeper. You know, maybe actually it's the ones when Man City have to play a little bit more in transition, where Mateus's ability to carry the ball comes into its own. But yeah, I can absolutely understand that. And to be honest, I'd be very surprised if he starts at the weekend against Fulham. But good time for City to have clicked into gear again, isn't it? You know, nice easy game against Fulham at the Etihad.
They've got a really easy run coming up, really, mate. They've got Fulham, who they always batter.
16 in a row, I believe.
Yeah. Haaland got a hat-trick last year, didn't he? Was it five last year? And they've got Wolves away. Maybe Nunez plays that one. Sparta Prague, they've got Southampton. There's four good games for City to have either side of the international break. So we'll see. Obviously, like they're still adapting
to life without Rodri.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is a good time. This is a good spell of games for them to get used to that, rather than spells they could have had that are a bit further down the line when they play like Brighton, Tottenham, Liverpool in successive games. So yeah, let's see how they get through it.
Yeah, okay. All right, let's round up the rest of them. I want to start with what I actually think was the best game of the night last night between the Dutch champions and the Portuguese champions, PSV Eindhoven, against Sporting Club de Portugal. And ended 1-1. Two excellent, excellent goals. The first from Jordi Scouten, who picks the ball up over last time's hero, Zeno de Bast, for Sporting, and unleashes a rocket into the top corner. But Amorim's side just will not go down. They won't go down without a fight. And Daniel Braganza, who is a Sporting Academy product, comes in and scores this like kind of Del Piero-esque flick into the top corner to equal the game, or to level the game, down towards the end of it. And it was a cracking game of football between two very, very good sides, two sides who have distinct and clear identities, two sides who know what they're doing, who are both still overwhelming favourites, despite what I said about Benfica earlier, you know, overwhelming favourites to go on and retain their league titles. And you think about, you know, the Eredivisie and the Primeira, and you're talking about the leagues that are sixth and seventh in the European order, right? These are quite widely accepted to be, you know, the leagues below the top five that have the best chance of kind of pushing up. I think that the gap is closing. I don't think there's all that much between the French league now, Liga, and the Primeira and the Eredivisie.
I think they're
all in that kind of closing gap. And it's interesting to watch sides like this, Sporting in particular, who have been so wedded to Amorim's identity for such a long period of time that they just have this innate sense of how they want to play. They're so front-footed. Even, you know, they go behind here and it's a bit of a tough goal to concede. They give the ball away stupidly, and then there's an absolute worldie. So it's like two things at once. You're like, one, we shouldn't have done that, and two, how's he pulled that out? And the way that they go about looking for this equalizer is really, really impressive. I said before that I think that they should and could go deep in this competition this year. I don't think Sporting are going to win it, but I think that they should probably be looking at the quarterfinal stages. Obviously, it depends on the draw, et cetera, but you look at that and think, well, there's no reason you shouldn't be in those kind of conversations with the way that you play and the talent that you have. And I don't think PSV are, well, clearly not, but don't think the PSV are miles behind them in terms of what they're trying to do either. So some you know, impressive, like kind of on the skirts of being dark horses teams here who people should be, you know, keeping an eye on. And I think that in terms of a competitive, solid game of football, this was probably Tuesday's best game.
Yeah, that's interesting. I like the point you make about the, you know, the Portuguese league and the Dutch league being competitive with Ligue 1, I definitely think that they are, especially once you, you know, evaluate.
You look at the Portuguese teams and the way that they've performed in Europe over the last couple of years. You look at the fact that, you know, we saw a couple, you know, obviously Feyenoord get to the Conference League final. Yes, obviously these are different competitions, but there's an impressive nature about what they're doing, I think.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's something we might have to dig into at some point, I think, like ranking who is the best fifth league in the world, because I think in Europe, I should say, because that Ligue 1 is definitely under threat right now. And I think that's not a bad thing at all. I mean, it's when you look at where players are coming from now, where you look at where players are going to emerge from, obviously France is still going to be a place where that happens, but Holland and Portugal is definitely the two that compete with it for me.
Yeah, I mean, look, we could use that, but also Lille also beat Real Madrid tonight, and I wanted to come on to Stade Brestois, or Brest, they're often known.
Brest are flying!
Who won 4-0 away at Salzburg. That's two Austrian teams they've played, so again, look at it slightly in that context.
Right, they're second in the league, Pirates, they're second in the Champions League.
The Pirates are plundering Austria right now, and that's pretty cool. Like, they've come to this competition, they're not allowed to play at their own home ground because it's not fit for purpose for UEFA. They win anyway on the opening day against Sturm Graz. Then they go to RB Salzburg, who, to be fair, have had a pretty difficult start to life back in the Champions League, and life under Pep Linders, who's having a slightly difficult time of it over there. And they absolutely annihilate them. Like, this is, you know, you talk about shock results, and obviously Dortmund's beating Celtic on Tuesday feels like the one in that kind of context because it was 7-1. But actually, Brest going to Salzburg and winning 4-0 might well be the result of the night. Villa might take away the result of the match day, but it's right up there. This was a shellacking that they handed out. And Abdallah Sima, who is an old friend of this podcast, someone we've talked about at length, on loan from Brighton, scores two of these. He was borderline unplayable. So shouts out to Brest. They've had a brilliant start. Salzburg a little bit all over the place.
Yeah, but they are. Yeah.
Long may it continue. May it continue. Not Salzburg, Brest.
Poor honesty.
We go on to, I said we'd go to Milan earlier, and I am going to take us there. Inter beat Red Star, was Sven Zvezda, 4-0. Interesting, this made a lot of changes in Zaghi. And when you're kind of looking at what he played up front, he played Taremi and Arnautovic. Taremi was brilliant, absolutely sensational, and really deserved his goal towards the end of this. They were able to allow Lautaro to come off the bench and do his thing. But Inter, completely and utterly controlled by Hakan Çalhanoğlu, who scored a wonderful free kick, controlled the entire game. It wasn't as comfortable as perhaps the scoreline suggests, but generally Inter doing what they needed to do. And that's a 0-0 draw away at City and a 4-0 home win to open their campaign. Mm. If you'd offered them that before this began, I think they would have bitten your hand off for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Taremi, that was probably one of the big takeaways of the game week, really. Very, very impressive from him. And, well, you can breathe now, mate. Is that, have you got through all of them? Have you not got through all of them? We haven't done all the teams yet. It's like hour three of the show.
One more game. Yeah, we're into our eighth now. I feel like I'm on the radio again. VfB Stuttgart drew 1-1 with Sparta Prague. Sparta Prague are really good. That's the takeaway from this game. They are not to be sniffed at. And we spoke about Stuttgart, right, after match week one, the performance they put in against Real Madrid. And we were there going, they're going to be a problem for teams. I tell you what, Sparta Prague went stride for stride with a very good Stuttgart side, who are a little bit inconsistent at times, fine. But they've had a really good start as well. That's 4 points for them. They had a brilliant win to kick things off. To go to Stuttgart and draw 1-1, this Sparta side are not to be sniffed at. They're going to be annoying for some of the bigger teams. Another team that you kind of look at the bottom and think, you know, when they draw one of the big guns or when those games come up, people are going to kind of dismiss that game. And look, these things happen. We see that teams occasionally get, you know, shellackings off people, but Sparta Prague are not in that same league of Young Boys and Sturm Graz that are going to go and take these results week in, week out. They're a really well put together unit, and they know exactly how to play under these European nights. They've had that kind of conditioning, if you will, in the Europa League and Europa Conference League. They've been involved in European nights for a long time at this point. And I thought it was very, very impressive what they did here. The way that they set up, the way that they nullified so many of Stuttgart's big threats. They very much deserved this point, I thought. And I am keeping an eye on Sparta Prague.
Me too then, mate. Me too.
There you are. Now I can breathe. There we are. We are wrapped. There you are. The 18 games of this week's Champions League all wrapped up for you. Some in more detail than others, obviously, on Ranks FC Champions League takeaway, which means that's all that's left for me to do is say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones all the way in San Diego.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC. We'll be back on Friday. Doogie and Sam will be here with another episode of The Truth, which this week they're talking about, is it now impossible for newly promoted sides to survive in the Premier League? It was a great discussion. Really enjoyed it. We looked at some of the things that help teams survive, look at some of the quirks that sometimes do make things easier, and why this year's crop might have some chance of actually breaking what happened last year. So make sure you're tuned in on Friday morning for that one. But for now, thank you so much for listening here on Champions League Takeaway. We really appreciate you as ever, and we'll see you very shortly, Rank Squad. Take it easy. Peace.